It's been an interesting season here at Unraveled. We looked at CDK inhibitors, the drugs that gum up the gears in a cell's reproduction machine. And we learned how those drugs, which were originally developed to treat leukemia, now help millions of breast cancer patients around the world. We heard about targeted therapies with the story of the EGFR gene. In that one, doctors took aim at a genetic mutation found in some lung cancer patients. And when they did, they helped usher in the age of precision medicine. We studied a family of drugs, thalidomide and its derivatives, that doctors had used for decades to treat myeloma, even though they didn't understand how that drug worked. And then we listened as Dana-Farber doctors and researchers retraced the steps they took to solve that mystery. Above all, season two has been the story of momentum, the story of an expanding universe of knowledge, strategies, and care. But as that universe expands, sometimes incrementally and more often exponentially, its new dimensions also create new challenges. The more we know, the better our tools are, the more choices we have, and that's great, but it's also hard to manage. It's hard to distill mountains of patient data, clinical trials, therapies, discoveries, and a boatload of externalities. Hard to distill all of these into the best possible research and care. Oh, and don't forget the human genome in its almost infinite complexity.
We've gone from looking at genes, one gene at a time, to now we are looking at, you know, cellular transcriptional readouts of single cells in tens, if not hundreds of thousands of them, across tens to hundreds of patients' tumors. I mean, the dimensionality is complicated, you know, and it just gets overwhelming when you try to think about it, absent sort of having some help.
Overwhelming unless we get some help. But what kind of human mind could provide that help? Could it be that the help we need, the intelligence we need, isn't human at all? I'm Ken Schulman, and this is Unraveled, a Dana-Farber Cancer Institute podcast. Unless you've been living in a cave for the past 10 years, or in a sensory deprivation tank, you know something about artificial intelligence. Terms like neural networks or machine learning may not live in your everyday vocabulary, but you've heard them, perhaps even used them, maybe more than once. And more than using those words, you've used those things. You've chatted with bots to help find your waylaid luggage. You've interacted and maybe even yelled at digital hosts about your cable bill. There are programs that keep you company or that suggest a TV series we think you'd like. There's even a bot that composes passable essays on command, a bot that recently typed its way into medical school. Sounds scary? It does to me. But for many doctors and researchers, AI, the software and algorithms and bots that make up the thing we call artificial intelligence, sounds like the help they need.
There's no reason why we couldn't take those same kinds of advances and the same kinds of energy and steer it into, you know, the most pressing matters of cancer medicine.
That's Ellie Van Allen. He's a Dana-Farber doctor who specializes in computational cancer genomics.
It's a field that's growing whereby we're trying to take all of the data from genomics and oncology, basically every patient's cancer genome that we're sequencing at Dana-Farber and elsewhere, and learn as much as we can from these data, and increasingly using sophisticated algorithms to find patterns, find these exquisitely complicated needles and exquisitely complicated haystacks, and really try to push the field forward.
Okay, time for a spot of commentary. The cancer genome. That's the exquisitely complicated haystack, the teeming web of mutations, proteins, enzymes, chromatin remodelers, immune cells, and environmental factors that govern tumor growth. And the exquisitely complicated needles? Those are the patterns, the irregularities, repetitions, and abnormalities, the things that machines are so much better at spotting than we are, and the things that let doctors ask the next questions.
Can we perturb these things? Can we drug these things? Can we somehow find the right patients to give these drugs to, and everything in between?
Van Allen grew up as a self-described computer geek in Southern California. He went to college at Stanford, planning to study computer science.
Sort of a funny thing happened, though, along the way. So while I was studying this and really sort of preparing myself for a career in this domain, taking computer science classes and learning about the field, some of my friends approached me to say, well, you know, we're interested in starting a nonprofit. It's a camp for kids whose parents had cancer. And I thought that sounded interesting. I thought I wanted to help. But I didn't really know what I was getting myself into.
That summer camp experience changed Van Allen's life. He decided to study medicine, cancer medicine in particular. But he took his interest in computers and artificial intelligence with him to medical school and to his residency. A lot of people scratched their heads.
There were people who would hear my interest and say, okay, well, you know, we can send you to talk to the folks building electronic health records and sort of that field of informatics, which is very important, but not really something that I was particularly excited about on a personal level. And then there were the folks who said, well, certainly there's a lot of opportunity for translational research and sort of like understanding foundational biology using computers, but that's not done by people like you, Ellie.
Van Allen came to Dana-Farber as a first-year fellow in June 2010. It was 1 week after the LA Lakers beat the Celtics in the NBA Finals. He remembers the faculty booing him, in good fun, when he introduced himself as a Laker fan. He also remembers running into a few headwinds when he said he wanted to work in oncology and in AI. He wasn't quite sure how he might merge these twin passions. Then one of his mentors, Bob Mayer, introduced him to Levi Garraway. Garraway was the director of the Joint Center for Cancer Precision Medicine. It's a cutting-edge collaboration between the Broad Institute, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Dana-Farber.
And he was really living and breathing what I was aiming for. He was at the forefront of precision cancer medicine and using genomics to sort of make treatment decisions for cancer patients across the board. But when I met with him within about 2 minutes, I still remember thinking, man, I don't understand 80% of the words coming out of this guy's mouth, but this is cool. This is for me. I know this is going to be the thing.
And just like that, Van Allen joined the Garraway Lab at Dana-Farber. His new boss gave him a daunting assignment.
When I started in Levi's lab, he sat me down and he said, look, we're about to start generating massive amounts of genomic data for each of our cancer patients. And I need you to come up with a way to find the needles in the haystack, which of these mutations in each patient's genome is something we can act upon clinically, we can give a drug for that's actionable.
This was new territory, not just for Van Allen, but for the field. The information was there, but it was a single kernel, a single needle, buried in bale upon bale of data. The Garraway Lab rose to the challenge. They built a tool, the first of its kind, a tool Van Allen calls an interpretation algorithm for cancer genomics to use at the point of care.
Which is a long-winded way of saying, here was a tool we built to help doctors use this complicated genomic information to find the right drugs for the right patients.
That algorithm was able to spot patterns camouflaged among ungodly gobs of patient data. And in those patterns was critical information about genetic mutations that were driving cancer.
One of those instances was actually in a patient with something called anaplastic thyroid cancer. This is a devastating disease for which the response rates to any therapeutic are basically nil. There really hasn't historically been a therapeutic strategy. And we had this one case of this one patient who had this profound response and a very unexpected one to a targeted therapy.
The patient he's speaking about had responded to a drug called everolimus. It's an mTOR inhibitor, a small molecule that binds to the mTOR receptor on the surface of a tumor cell. That bond, when it works, blocks the cell cycle. It keeps tumor cells from replicating. Everolimus is rarely effective in anaplastic thyroid cancer. Van Allen and his colleagues were stumped as to why it worked in this patient. But the algorithm singled in on a genetic mutation that made this patient's cancer vulnerable to the mTOR inhibitor. And it didn't take weeks or days or even hours to find.
The old-fashioned way to do this would have been to actually have to spend just extraordinary amounts of time trying to fish through this massive haystack. But with the algorithm we made, it took it about 10 seconds. Basically, within 10 seconds, we're like, oh, that's it. That explains it. And in fact, now we need to then bring this back to the clinician and make sure we find the other patients like this patient and get these patients on these drugs.
10 seconds to scan that spiraling ladder of sugars and phosphates and bases that compose the human genome. 10 seconds to scan the 3.2 billion base pairs. Those are the rungs on that spiraling ladder, the ones that determine whether we'll have blue eyes or brown. 10 seconds to do that and cross-reference those 3.2 billion base pairs with thousands of possible mutations, mutations that might be driving cancer. That is one heck of a haystack.
What we would typically have to do is manually go through all of them one by one and try to figure out which things are important. And in fact, that was sort of the standard of care at the time. People were having molecular tumor boards where they would take these data and put it basically into a spreadsheet, project the spreadsheet into a room, and a bunch of people would stare at it. Hope being that if you were lucky, somebody in the room recognized, oh, that thing, and then would act upon it. I'm obviously being a little loose on it, but that's basically what was happening.
The algorithm Van Allen and his lab mates built took a problem that in the old days might have taken days or weeks to solve and figured it out in the time it takes an Olympic sprinter to run 100 meters. But that's not all it did.
It would do, 99% of the heavy lifting for you and find the actionable alterations, find which ones of them might be more important than others, find which one of them might actually have other relationships to other events in the genome, and then also, critically, present this information in a way that a treating provider could actually understand.
The heavy lifting, sifting through those 3.2 billion base pairs, locating mutations and linking those to cancer, that may be the most impressive part of the operation. But Van Allen says the last part, making the findings accessible to doctors in the clinic, may be the most important.
Because if we fail that last step, we could have the most sophisticated algorithms in the world, but it won't matter because the person making the decision won't understand what they're looking at and will just, be inclined not to use it. Or even worse, make the wrong decision.
Back in 2010, and even a few years after that, people like Ellie Van Allen, doctors who wanted to build a bridge between machine learning and medicine, sometimes had a tough time finding a place to land. It's not like that today. Lots of labs at Dana-Farber and elsewhere have data scientists and AI specialists working side by side with geneticists, biologists, and physicians. But acceptance doesn't always mean assimilation. There is still, at times, failure to communicate.
Half of us were just pumping out data, and then the other half of us were getting said data and doing analysis on it. And so it was a lot of people that spoke one language but not the other, so to speak.
That's Jackson Nyman, a systems biologist from Harvard, who works in the Van Allen lab. He just defended his doctoral thesis in March.
I personally wanted to exist in that space where I could kind of speak both languages and try to make the best out of both of them or start to facilitate some of that interaction.
Nyman started his PhD in 2017 with Van Allen as his thesis advisor. The project? To see if it might be possible to use imaging and machine learning to predict whether a specific cancer patient would respond to a specific therapy. The specific therapy here was immunotherapy, the PD-1 blockade, and the specific cancer was kidney cancer.
This is a cancer where it's actually really common to use immunotherapy, even in the kind of first line or initial treatment setting at this point. So there's a big need to try to understand which patients respond and why, or rather, which don't respond well.
We've already heard about using AI to sift through genetic sequences, through the haystack of 3.2 billion base pairs. What Nyman was trying to do here was different. Pathologists often use imaging, pictures of tumors and tumor sections, to diagnose individual cancers and prescribe treatment. Nyman wanted to use AI to scan those and pinpoint physical features that might be correlated with drug response or drug resistance. Essentially, he wanted to train a machine to home in on details in a picture that could tell doctors whether immunotherapy would work or not work. Now, this wasn't just a handful of images. There were hundreds of thousands of them at very high resolution. It's hard to even guess how long a team of pathologists might take to leaf through and analyze that volume of pixels.
But if we just run it through some of our AI models that can recapitulate some of these same things, all of a sudden we have this really detailed map for hundreds or thousands of patients that is just directly ready for downstream analysis. I can start to see, like, are there properties that are shared between patients from this lens? Are there certain combinations of features that might be important and things that might be kind of hard to see if you didn't quantify it with a computer?
It's important to note that Nyman wasn't working in real time with real patients. The outcomes here were already known. The AI team was working backwards to see if there was a pattern or patterns that connected physical features of the tumor with drug response or drug resistance.
Sometimes you have a patient tumor where the whole thing is basically consistent. It's one pattern versus the other. But then other times, and this is something that's kind of been, it's been described before, but hasn't been quantified, you get this co-occurrence. And so for our particular work, this was actually really important because when we looked at cases that had this co-occurrence, it appears to correlate with different clinical outcomes, actually.
When we talk about artificial intelligence, about training machines to spot microscopic aberrations in tumor cells, we're also talking about neural networks. That's the artificial intelligence, a network of digital circuitry, layers upon layers of it, that we can train to tell us if something is a cat, and even if the cat is alive or dead or both. But here's the creepy thing. Not only do these neural networks learn, they also correct themselves. If they make a bad call, they'll tweak their connections all on their own. It's this last part, this computer heal thyself, that Nyman and many in AI find troubling, because these machines don't always stay on mission. Philosophers may debate whether these neural nets actually have a mind, but if they do, sometimes they seem to have a mind of their own.
It might just be learning something else that's not actually related to a cancer. It might be something really mundane. These models that we're using, neural networks in general, are only as smart as what we give it. So in a lot of the cases, if there's a shortcut to be taken, they will take it because these models have way too much modeling power behind them. It's a double-edged sword. They're really good when they work.
Because they are really good when they work, neural nets and other forms of AI have found their way into almost every corner of our lives, from spell check to smartphones to self-driving cars.
And artificial intelligence is becoming used more and more in oncology, but there certainly are some ethical issues with its deployment.
That's Gregory Abel. He's a doctor at Dana-Farber and co-chair of the Ethics Advisory Committee there. That committee serves as a sounding board for Dana-Farber officers and physicians and staff, and for patients and their families, for anyone who needs support navigating the difficult decisions that cancer and cancer care so often raise. Among his many other duties, Abel works with Ellie Van Allen and several other colleagues to sketch out an ethical framework for AI deployment at Dana-Farber. One of the first features, one of the first concerns in that sketch is equity. The concern that AI will mostly benefit wealthy or well-connected patients, or that AI will be used as a cost-effective substitute for FaceTime with real physicians, as in, I'm sorry, the doctor won't see you now, but here's my friend RoboDoc.
Like many innovations in oncology, they tend to appear first for people who are well-resourced. So if we find really good AI and it's being used in oncology, it may take a while to get to patients that are more disadvantaged. On the other hand, if we start to use AI instead of clinical encounters and our clinical in judgment, we may find that the most resourced patients are the ones that still have that patient-physician relationship where there's less AI in the room. So it's sort of a double-edged sword.
Equity in AI doesn't just mean an equitable distribution of care. There's an equity problem in data sets as well. These data sets don't always represent all groups. There can be gaps. Data from certain ethnicities, genders, or social classes might be absent. And if there are gaps, a patient from one of those underrepresented groups may not get the most precise diagnosis or prognosis, even if the AI follows every rule and protocol. It's called data absenteeism, or in some circles, data chauvinism. AI didn't create this problem, but it can exacerbate it.
Another piece of my work is to try and make sure that we have people of color in trials, that we make sure that we address the data absenteeism, even data chauvinism that we see in data sets. Sometimes we'll say, well, if it's a mutation, it doesn't matter. If it's in a person of color or a white person, that mutation will act in this way. But there are so many other factors that could also affect the environment of that same mutation. To me, you need to have people of all groups, hopefully, in your data set that you are basing your AI on.
Deploying AI in oncology also heats up the tug of war between transparency, that free flow of information that brings oxygen to science, and patient privacy. Patients willingly share their personal information and medical histories with their own treatment team, but they may not want to share that same information with a team on another floor, let alone clinical trial partners halfway around the world.
Transparency can be limited by privacy concerns because the more transparent we are, then we may be revealing what patients are actually, you know, in the database that the AI was based on, and that's not okay. So with some rare cancers, just knowing the rare cancer, the age, and maybe the sex of a person and where they live, you could probably figure out who it is. And so that's a really important point. On the other hand, I do think that patients want to help. You know, there's always been altruism in medicine. It's why a lot of patients with advanced disease participate in trials. And so if they, by having their data in a database that AI can use, I think a lot of patients want that and are interested in that.
Transparency in AI and in cancer care also means a free flow of information between doctor and patient to give patients the information they need to make informed choices about their care, to stay in the driver's seat. With AI, that isn't always easy, because AI can be opaque. Even data scientists sometimes can't explain how this mechanical brain, how this black box, reaches its conclusions. Abel says doctors just need to be honest.
We have to help patients to understand the usefulness of this, the inexplicability of some of it, how even the best AI models sometimes fail. Every person is unique. Even if the AI says something that's going to happen, it may not happen. And that's where I think we have a real role to play as oncologists in terms of really packaging the AI and explaining it. Even if we can't understand exactly how it's working, some of the limitations and also some of the wonderful things that can result from it.
And there are many wonderful things that can come of it, some that we can imagine and some that we can't. Abel even thinks doctors might one day use AI to help make ethical decisions in deciding, for example, how to parcel out a drug, a leukemia drug, for example, when that drug is in short supply. Do you give it to the sickest patients, to the youngest patients?
And I could see how that might be something that artificial intelligence could do, where we could actually turn it back on itself and say, okay, here's two ethical approaches to something. Let's use, you know, an AI model to help us figure out, using both approaches, which we feel are both valid, actually ends up saving more lives. And then you'd say, okay, we're not sure which is the best approach ethically. They're both defensible. But this one, actually, the data shows through this AI model, might actually be a little bit better in terms of saving lives. So we do that one.
Artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, neural nets, these are all components of a system that has changed our lives and will undoubtedly change them even more in years to come. They'll change oncology as well, just as profoundly. Doctors like Gregory Abel and Ellie Van Allen want to remind us that in the beginning and in the end, these things are tools. New tools with capabilities and potential we're just beginning to sound. And like all tools, they work best and do the least harm in the hands of thoughtful humans. Thoughtful humans, Van Allen says, from many different disciplines.
Certainly our lab, and certainly there's a few other labs in our environment that are excited about this, but it's not just us. It's actually a larger initiative and a larger effort across the entire campus. Having ethicists involved, having implementation scientists involved, having health services researchers involved, but bringing them into some of these new spaces sort of as part of a larger community is actually something we're now doing across the board.
This is our final episode of Unraveled, Season 2. We've told the story of research that drives clinical trials that test and refine new therapies, and new therapies are just as often existing therapies used in new ways that help patients live longer and healthier lives. It's a story of momentum, a Mobius loop of science and clinic and care, now animated by a new brand of intelligence that promises to step up that momentum. I can't wait to see how all that works out. But until then, I'm Ken Schulman, and this is Unraveled, a Dana-Farber Cancer Institute podcast.
What is it about Dana-Farber that makes it such a powerful adversary against cancer? It's hundreds of Dana-Farber researchers and clinicians making new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber discoverers. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, nothing is as effective against cancer as a relentless succession of breakthroughs. Go to danafarber.org/stories and see how what we do here changes lives everywhere.